Now we're privileged to bring up Brother Tom Ruggiero one more time, and his discourse for this session is The Hand of Providence, a Testimony. Brother Tom.
Thank you, Brother Peter. I have to tell you, it's been a thorough delight for me and Leah to be here with you. Thank you for giving me the privilege to do this. This is probably going to go in a different direction than you might expect. Now, I'll explain that in a little bit. But providence is something that's very important to us. It's one of the ways we have to try to discern what the Lord's will is for us. We often hear Isaiah 30:21 associated with God's providence. It says, "Thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, This is the way, walk ye in it, when ye turn to the right hand and when ye turn to the left." You read that scripture, it sounds, well, it should be pretty easy. Just listen to the voice behind you. But of course, it's not always that easy at all. There is no literal word that comes from God that shows us which path we should take. And I think that's what makes the Lord's providence sometimes so difficult to find. And of course, another difficulty in understanding God's providence is ourselves. You know, we often want something to go a certain direction, and so we tend to interpret providence that, okay, he's showing me that way, even if he may not be really showing it to you. And so we often learn by making mistakes, and we are trying to learn to distinguish our voice from the voice of providence. I think a mature Christian has a better handle on that over time. The dictionary definition for providence says that it is the foreseen care and guidance of God. On reprint 1560, I think Brother Russell makes some very excellent observations about divine providence. I'm going to read a few of them. This is what he says. He says, "To rightly understand the subject, we must carefully observe the scripturally marked meets and bounds within the limits of which divine providence can be and is exercised." And then in the article, he gives three limiting factors to divine providence. And these are limits that God has put on himself. First, he says, "Since God is good, all his providences must be with a view to wise and benevolent ends, either near or remote. And second, since he made man in his own image, that is morally free, and with the alternatives of good and evil before him, it would be contrary to his purpose to hedge him about with his providences as to interfere with his free moral agency. And third, since God is working all things according to a plan of the ages, it is manifest that he cannot exercise his providence in any way which would be detrimental to the ultimate ends of his perfect plan." Very good guidelines for the Lord's providence. So let me just summarize them real quick. God's providence will only be exercised for wise and benevolent purposes. God's providence will never overrule an individual's free moral agency. And God's providence will never contradict his purpose in the divine plan. I'd recommend that you read that article, 1560. In that article, Brother also talks about how God's providence is used to supervise his dominion of the universe. And that article is where that wonderful quote is taken from, which says in part that God is the great emperor of the whole universe, and his wisdom, power, goodness, and benevolence are abundantly equal to all the responsibilities of so exalted an office. The human mind staggers in its efforts to comprehend the mental resources of a being who is able to assume and to bear such responsibility. And then he goes on to eloquently describe the memory that never fails, the judgment that never makes a mistake, the wisdom that plans for eternity without the possibility of failure. And I think it's one of the most fascinating paragraphs or accumulation of paragraphs that Brother Russell ever wrote. And it makes me realize that my general definition of providence is really small. It thinks on a small level. I usually think of it in my own personal life, you know, that he intervenes in my life's affairs and sometimes overrules things that I experience. And of course, that's true. But when we think of God as the creator of all things and the amazing responsibility that he bears in maintaining his creation, we realize on how many different levels that providence must act. The article goes on to say that no one can fully comprehend the providence of God, but oh, what a thrilling sense of mingled reverence, love, and adoration fills the heart when thus we catch a glimpse of the intellectual and moral glory and majesty of our God, And as we thus contemplate him, all nature becomes eloquent with his praise. The heavens truly declare his glory, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. And so if we could really see all the workings of God's providences on all its many different levels, the huge ones and the minute ones, I think, what's the word say? We would be blown away. We would simply be amazed. Well, for today, I'd like to kind of focus on the minutiae of one life in particular, and that's why I call this talk, The Hand of Providence, a testimony. This really isn't a discourse. It's a testimony about one particular life. In the story I'm going to share with you, I didn't want this just to be about the person I'm talking about, but I want it to be an opportunity for each of you to look at your own lives, to look at the lives of your parents or your grandparents or even siblings or whatever the Lord used to bring you to where you are today. And I would suggest that as you do that, you write it down and that you make a memoir of how you came to the Lord and where you stand today. And use that not just to remind yourself of the blessings of the past, but as an opportunity of the Lord, of thanking the Lord for all the miracles that have happened in your past, in your family. Well, to get us started along those lines, I'm going to tell you about an experience in my father's life. I've talked about him before, and I don't want to over-talk about him. but recently, this idea of providence and looking at his life, it just opened up an avenue of thought and understanding that has simply amazed me. And I will freely admit to you that I am not sure I am grasping this properly, that I'm not seeing that through my own will, through my own rose-colored glasses. But if I'm seeing what I think I am seeing in his life, then the Lord's providence also looked into the future to the family that he would have, that he would have some members of my dad's family consecrate and run for the prize of the high calling. And I thought about that. I said, oh, come on, does the Lord really do that? And does he look into the future to see coming generations and then alter his providence in order to prepare things for family members? And I think the answer at least can be yes, he can do that. We know he can do that. For example, the Persian King Cyrus is mentioned in Scripture by name some 150 years before he became king. God was able to look ahead into the future and know that there would be a king who would be named Cyrus, and this is what I'm going to commission him to do. Isaiah here is quoting the words of God. He says to Cyrus, "You are my shepherd. You will do what I want. You will say to Jerusalem, you will be rebuilt. You will tell the temple your foundations will be put in place." 150 years before Cyrus came on the scene. And according to Josephus, when Cyrus heard of Isaiah's prophecy, he was convinced to allow Jews to return to Israel and rebuild the temple and the city. He saw that there was something greater than him at work here. And so the Lord was preparing the work for Cyrus to do to sponsor the rebuilding of Israel after the captivity. And so here again, God looked forward in time to prepare Cyrus as an instrument for advancing God's plan. And of course, in our studies of prophecy, we know that Napoleon, although not specifically mentioned by name, is described in great detail in the book of Daniel. So here's a couple of scriptural examples of how the Lord can look into the future and know who will be there and what their circumstances will be. How else can you have control of eternity forward without knowing how the future will be? And I'll tell you, brethren, I think I've seen that in my life, in my family's life. And again, I want to tell you, this is not meant to brag or to say, look at us. Please don't get that from this. I'm just saying this is simply what I believe is my family's providence and how the Lord has dealt with us over three generations. And I want you to do that exercise. Please go home and look at your past and look at what your family history is, how the Lord brought you here, and you will see God's hand in your own lives. Okay, I'll tell you, when I was growing up, I would hear stories of my father's experiences during World War II. And I heard bits and pieces of some very interesting experiences. I think he just needed to talk about these things. And then as I became an adult, I realized that these were significant enough that I should preserve them. And so I did. I did an interview with my dad, and I recorded it. He told us in great detail of his war experiences and how even back then he saw the Lord's hand in his life. And I started the recording by simply saying, "Tell us your story." And he said, ah, what's to tell? But I knew he wanted to tell us. There was a lot to tell. And I'm not even going to get to all of it today, but it's a fascinating story, at least for me. And a little later, I'm going to even let you hear some of his own words about the Lord's care over this totally insignificant Italian soldier during World War II who was sent to the Russian front during the depths of winter. Now, the experience for him began, of course, when he was drafted into the Italian army. This was, of course, long before he became a Bible student. And, you know, in all these experiences I'm going to be relating, I think of the tabernacle picture and how the Lord begins the drawing process while people are still way out in the camp, who really don't have a deep appreciation of anything in the court, but there's an interest that's drawing them. My dad was way out in the camp. He didn't really have any relationship with the Lord on a covenant basis, but these experiences would slowly draw him in. I mean, when you see miracles happen in your life, the right response is to draw closer to the one who did those miracles. Not everyone has that. Well, his initial time of service in the army was 18 months. So when he was first inducted, he asked to be stationed in Africa. And I said, why would you want to go to Africa of all places? He said, I've never been out of Italy. And I thought it would be interesting to go somewhere else. And they paid a little bit more. And so he spent 13 to 14 months in Libya. This was before the war. And so after his discharge, he went home. But after a short time, he was drafted again because on June 10th, 1940, Italy entered the war. And as you know, Italy was part of the Axis power, allied with Germany. And of course, when I was a kid, I didn't like that. I said, what were you doing on their side? But of course, he had no choice. He had to do what he was told. And after training as an auto mechanic, he was sent to a post near Rome. When he got there, he met a good friend of his from Corleone, where he was born, who happened to be a colonel and who had some authority there. And so under this friend's influence, he was able to stay near Rome for about 6 months, which he thought was a small providence. It was a good place to be. But then in 1942, he was sent to the Russian front. And he said it took 2 weeks on train to get to Russia from Italy. You remember your history. The Italian dictator Benito Mussolini believed that the war was going to be short, that Germany was invincible, that victory was assured, and so he wanted to make his claim on some of the conquered territories. In fact, he actually wanted to reestablish the glory of the Roman Empire. Now, there have been a number of books written about the Italian army's experience at the Russian front, and I'd like to quote from one titled Few Returned. It was written by a young Italian lieutenant who was in Russia at the same time as my dad and whose descriptions match my dad almost exactly. This is what he writes. The Italian fighting units sent to the Eastern Front in the summer of 1941 were held in utter contempt by their German ally. The Italian 8th Army was deemed fit only for a minor defensive role, and they saw little significant action until late 1942. When the Russians assembled four armies consisting of 1 million troops, nearly 1,000 tanks, and an equal number of attack aircraft, launched a giant two-pronged winter counteroffensive across a wide front in southern Russia. The 8th Army was simply no match against this massive Red Army juggernaut and was quickly overwhelmed. Not only were the Italians woefully clothed, but they also lacked tanks and anti-tank guns with which to defend themselves. Within hours, the Don River front disintegrated. To avoid death or capture, the Italian and German troops trapped in the Don pocket began retreating in a desperate attempt to break free of encirclement. The flight of the Italians became a horrific odyssey, carried out in extreme sub-zero temperatures, often as low as minus 30 degrees. Unlike the Germans, who were occasionally resupplied by air, the Italians were left largely to fend for themselves, with only whatever each individual soldier could carry on his own back or drag on makeshift sleds. The Italians were generally clad in warm weather shoes that many replaced with straw and blankets torn into strips and wrapped around their feet. Bereft of ammunition, resupply, or transport, the Italians marched on foot across the bleak, frozen wilderness of Russia, virtually without sleep, in the dead of winter, through some of the most desolate terrain on earth. They left in their wake a trail of corpses and abandoned equipment. Only the fittest and the luckiest survived the 28-day ordeal. Finally, in mid-January 1943, the survivors at last managed to break free of the Russian trap the Italian Eighth Army had ceased to exist. In addition to those who died in the fighting during the retreat from the Don River, the official Italian historians later determined that some 50,000 to 60,000 Italian soldiers were captured by the Russians and sent to POW camps. Only 10,300 were later repatriated. The rest are thought to have died from abuse, starvation, and disease in the unspeakable conditions of captivity. Well, of course, there are tons of horror stories about World War II and the suffering and tragedy that happened all over the place. My dad and his fellow soldiers could not have known what they were getting into. The greed and pride of the misguided leadership of Mussolini brought terrible consequences on the Italian people. And that goes back to the lesson of this morning about poor leadership. Poor leadership in Italy caused the Italian people to suffer greatly. And so my dad was part of a history that won't soon be forgotten, part of the necessary consequences of the permission of evil when fallen men are allowed to foster such ambitious and terrible schemes. What he told me in my interview with him parallels exactly what's recorded in this book. He even used similar terminology. He said that the Russians had them surrounded like they were in a sack and that it was no longer a fight. He said, I didn't have to shoot a gun. We had no bullets anyway. For the Italian soldiers, this was all about survival. And I wasn't aware of that book before my father died. My older brother Joe had come across it, and I think if I would have known about the book, I would have asked my dad if he knew the author, Eugenio Corti, because his descriptions are so close to what my dad described. They were experiencing the same things. In fact, there's one interesting overlap of their stories that I'll mention in a little bit. On his way to Russia, my dad described seeing men jackhammering the ice on the river in order to get water. And he says it looked like the ice was about 3 feet thick. And he said, I saw trucks driving on the river. I had never seen anything like that before. He said, I thought it was a big open field that these trucks were driving back and forth, and it turned out to be a frozen lake in the river. You know, living in Sicily all his life, he had never seen anything like this, never experienced any kind of cold like this. He was 26 years old when all this happened. I think maybe his youth had a lot to do with him surviving. I asked him how he stayed warm, and he said, you know, the Germans had excellent boots. And since he was a sergeant, he was given a pair of those boots by the Germans. And he said that his feet were like they were in an oven, is the way he described it. And I said, yeah, well, I doubt that. But he said they saved his feet. And he also said that he had taken a wool cap off a dead soldier, and that helped keep his head warm. And one story that he told was when the Russians were closing in because the Italian tanks had run out of gas. His army was all spread out. And as he walked, he found two horses and a wagon, probably similar to this. He took it, and he was riding in the wagon, and he picked up four other Italian soldiers who were walking. But then as the Russians closed in, they took 1,000 Italian prisoners, and of course they took my dad in the horse and wagon. And as they continued riding in the wagon, they were coming up a valley where the Germans were at the top. And he said, the Germans started shooting at us, even though we were on their side, because they thought we had simply given up. He said, but there was nothing we could do. And so they were captured by the Russians, and the Germans are shooting at them. And it was a really terrible position to be in. And then the Russian commander who was in charge of the prisoners, he said, somehow communicated with my dad that he wanted to get down off the wagon and start walking with the others. And my dad says, well, you know, we really can't get down because these guys in the back, you know, they're frostbitten, they can't walk. He says, yeah, it probably wasn't true because they were walking when I picked them up. But that white lie probably saved their lives. The Russian commander then ordered one Russian soldier to go with them and bring them back to the Russian rear. And as they went up, they were going up again up to the top of this ridge, and the Germans and Russians were shooting at each other, and my dad said to the Russian, I don't know how they communicated, but somehow they did, that he said, we probably shouldn't go up there. Why don't we go down into the valley rather than into the fighting? And the Russian agreed, and so they ended up going down away from the fighting. And sometime later, as they were moving, the wagon hit a tree stump, and the harness broke. And as they tried to fix the harness, the Russian soldier asked if he had anything to eat. And my dad said, well, I don't know, look around the wagon. And there was some food in the wagon. And with the food, he also found 2 or 3 barrels of honey. He called them barrels. I don't know if they were really like the kind of barrels we know of, but So anyway, the group sat around for an hour. They ate, and they had some honey, and they fixed the wagon, and they kept going. And they eventually came across some small huts similar to this one. And when they went in, they found that the hut was full of Italian soldiers, wounded or frozen, one or the other. And my dad was able to share the honey that he still had left over with the soldiers in the hut. And this is where the two stories between my dad's story and the book overlap, because the book also mentions that someone had found some honey and started sharing it with others. And I thought, no, there's my dad. It had to be. How many people would have a barrel of honey in Russia? I thought, what were the odds of finding two horses and a wagon that had food in it in the middle of a Russian winter during a brutal war? And I thought, boy, the hand of providence seemed to be acting for him. So he was starting to see miracles in delivering him from those circumstances. And after a while, the Russian soldier wanted to leave because there was a German counteroffensive coming. And my dad again said, none of these guys can walk. You know, there's nothing we can do. They're not going to get up and go with you as a prisoner. And so the Russian soldier had a decision to make. Normally, if you can't take your prisoners with him, you kill them. In this case, I'm not sure why he didn't, but he just chose to leave. Maybe there were too many to kill, or maybe he thought, well, these people had been kind of kind to me. They gave me food and honey. So anyway, he just left without doing anything. So he was free from captivity. And although it's tarnished now, I want to show you this. Now, my dad actually was awarded the silver medal for helping the wounded. And he kind of laughed, you know, silver medal wasn't the highest medal you can get. There was a gold medal, but you had to be wounded to get the gold medal. And since I was never wounded and I survived, I only got the silver. I said, well, I'm really glad you got the silver and not the gold. That always hung in our house everywhere we went. Well, of the 30,000 Italian soldiers who were surrounded by the Russians, only 4,000 survived. That's only about 13%. And my dad was one of them and part of that long march west out of Russia. He also talked of one incident as he was walking that he saw a helmet on the ground. And he said, you know, maybe it's a good idea that I put that helmet on. And I don't know if he was exaggerating, but he said, as soon as I put that helmet on my head, a random bullet zinged me in the helmet. And he said, my ears were ringing for hours, but it probably saved his life again. And in his broken English, he said, the Lord provides in everything. I don't know what the Lord can do. And I'm not sure what he meant, but I think what he meant was that he didn't realize the type of miracles the Lord would do for him, and that the Lord could know that in about 30 seconds there's going to be a bullet coming at your head, and I'm going to stop it. As he walked further, he said that a bomb exploded nearby and it shred his coat, but he wasn't hurt at all. And so he thought there was another deliverance, you know, because under those brutal conditions, almost any type of wound would have been fatal, especially if he couldn't walk. In one place they came across, the soldiers nicknamed Death Valley. He said, because there were so many dead men that we were literally walking on top of them. And as they kept walking west, they came to a large city, and they found deep trenches that the Russians had dug. Doug, and he says, we couldn't go in the trenches because they were full of dead Russian soldiers. So, you know, you think about, what do they call it, post-traumatic stress? And back then, there was no such thing, or no knowledge. And I don't know how he dealt with that afterwards, but he did. And he says that's where he took the cap off the dead Russian. He laughed kind of and said, well, he wasn't going to need it anymore, but it sure was going to do me a lot of good, and it did. And so now he's wearing German boots, a Russian hat, and of course his Italian coat. And he said again, when I put the Russian cap on my head was like it was in an oven. And again, he was exaggerating, but I knew what he meant. And I asked him how he kept his hands warm, and he says, you know, I made sure that I never touched anything metal, metallic. I always kept my gloves on, and I tried to keep them in my pocket as much as I could. But I remember as a kid thinking he really had ugly hands, you know, really hard and brittle. And I always thought it was because he worked so hard, but I don't think hard work does that to his hands. I think he did have some residual effects from the cold. You know, this was such a chaotic and confusing retreat that as he walked, at one point he said he found himself all alone. And again, something unusual happened. He came across a single horse that was tied up. And he said, I tried to get on that horse, but I was so weak that I couldn't get up. He hadn't eaten anything for a long time, but been walking for days in the bitter cold. And so he says, I found a little hill, and I climbed up on the hill myself, and then I was able to get on the horse. And as he rode a little way, he said he came across two German soldiers who said that the horse was theirs. And he says, I didn't know it was yours. I just knew I couldn't walk very much, and I needed help, so I just took it. And so he got down, and he gave the horse back to them. Yeah, I'm going to play part of the audio from my dad's own words, so you can see what happened next. Now, the words he says, I'll also have on the screen, because it's a little hard to understand with his accent. So this is his own description of what happened next.
After we were the horse, they walked about 5-6 feet away from me. They started shooting my leg
with the machine gun.
And another guy said, stop it, what are you shooting for? One shot, another guy stopped. Man decided maybe he could be shooting more, you know. So when they finished shooting, I see my coat full of holes with the shooting. I look at my leg was broken. Nothing happened to my leg. When they wanted to put their something on my leg. Put their hand anyway. Well, anyway, the Lord never leave me for 1 minute. And a lot of people have tear the fruits and everything. They didn't want to hear it fall on my head. Nothing.
I don't know that I could have said it any better. Maybe the Lord put something around my legs. He put his hand anyway. The Lord never leave me for 1 minute. Not even one hair fell off my head. I don't know if that's out of providence. And as I think about that, stop it. As I think about what the Lord did for my dad, I have to think that he did it for me too, and for my family. And I ask again, is it possible that the Lord looks ahead? To see what a man will become. And it's just his providence. I'm sorry. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be surprised if he did. And if he did, he's showing me a being with more wisdom and power than I can possibly understand. And if I am grasping all this correctly, it gives me a message. Not only do I owe the Lord a great debt, but I owe it to my dad as well, because the Lord must have seen something in him to do what he did for him. And of course, that all gives me a responsibility to live the most dedicated life I can, because that's really the only way that I can show my appreciation for all this and realize that this isn't just a story. This is the Lord's hand doing great things for my family. And I hope that my kids and even future family members can see the lesson as well. And be moved by the possibility that the Lord could look ahead multiple generations and see that those generations are worth the effort. Brethren, the story doesn't end here by any means. I hope I'm not taking too much time of this and making this too personal, but I have to tell you the rest. Sorry. When my dad finally got back to Italy, he was given a month's leave to rest and recuperate. And at the end of his leave, he went back north to his regiment. And just about that time, Italy signed an armistice agreement with the Allied powers. The war was over for Italy, or so they thought at first. Adolf Hitler was so enraged by what he called Italy's betrayal that he actually sent German troops to occupy Italy. The Italian army was disbanded. There was no protection for any of the soldiers. And my dad, along with many other Italian soldiers, were actually arrested by the Germans. He said that he was arrested here somewhere between Naples and Rome. They were put on a cattle car, packed like animals, and they were headed north, he thought probably to Germany. And I asked him, you know, why he thought they were going to Germany. He says, well, probably to work. And so I assumed that they were being taken to a POW work camp. And he says, I'm not sure where we're going, but I was sure of one thing, that I didn't want to go. And so he tried to plan a way to escape. He had noticed two small windows near the top of the boxcars and decided that at some point he was going to try to get out of them. Here's a picture of a Nazi boxcar that was actually being brought to a museum in Florida. You can see a little small window there at the top. Now, this particular one has barbed wire over it. My dad didn't say anything about barbed wire, so either his boxcar didn't have it or he was able to squeeze through. He said somewhere north of Bologna, he said, after traveling some 350 miles on the train, he was able to jump out. He said the night he picked happened to be perfect. It was pitch black. There was no moon. And as the train approached the station, it slowed down enough that he could jump off. And when he landed, he said, I had to kneel motionless next to the tracks so the German guards sitting at each end of the boxcar wouldn't see him. And after the train passed, he walked until he saw a small farmhouse. And when he knocked on the door, he said the people were afraid because it was night and it was a troublous time. So they said, you can stay in our barn. And so he did for the night, but the next morning he told me he had to get out of this uniform. This uniform wasn't helping him. So they actually gave him some clothes, and he left, and he did something very interesting. He walked back to the train station where he had jumped off, and he bought a ticket back south to Rome. That may not have been such a good idea. Rome was a dangerous place for a young Italian 27-year-old man. Here's a picture of Italian civilians being arrested in Rome by German troops following a partisan attack a day earlier. So though they had been allies with Germany, because of the Italian armistice, they now become enemies and had to endure German occupation. What a reversal. Now, it's not clear when or how, but at some point my dad's brother had given him a name of a family in Rome that he could contact if he ever needed help, and he kept that with him. And he somehow found the family, and he asked them for help, but they were terrified. They wouldn't help him. But they knew of somebody who might. And so they gave him another name and address, and he found them, and they were willing to help. He said that he hid in their house for some 9 months. He said during those 9 months, he said for one stretch, he had not gone outside for 3 months because of the German presence. In fact, the family ran a small business where they made socks and sweaters. He says, you know, I wanted to learn how to help them, and they happened to have a broken machine that they weren't using, so I was able to fix it, and he was so proud that the first day he was with them, he made 30 pairs of socks. He said, well, good, you're earning your keep. Well, on June 4th, 1944, the Allies took Rome, and the war was finally over for him, so he can go back home to Sicily. Well, brethren, that's the story of my dad's war experiences. There's another short series of events that led him to the Bible students, but I'll let you judge for yourself if these were divine providences. You know, so many little pieces, the German boots, the Russian hat, the horses and wagon, the food they found and the honey, the helmet and the bullet that had stopped, the bomb exploding and shredding his coat, not being taken prisoner while resting in that Russian hut, the German firing at his legs without touching him, escape from the Russian sack, escape from a Nazi prisoner train, and the help of strangers in Rome. I think, can these all be coincidences? And I think that might take more imagination than to believe that the Lord really had wrapped his hand around him. And you know, what's amazing about the story is that we get a glimpse of the extremes of divine providence. Germany was not going to win the war. The Lord's going to make sure of that. In fact, the German loss in Russia was a turning point of World War II, and it showed the world that Germany was not invincible. As the German invasion struggled through the terrible Russian winter, it had no more success in spring when the ground thawed and turned into impassable mud, trapping the German vehicles. And so on a large scale, providence worked to defeat the Axis forces. But within that large providence, the Lord saw an insignificant Italian soldier who was on the German side, but a man who I think had a good heart and was willing to help others. Providence works on a small scale with one individual, while at the same time working on a large scale to control the outcome of the war. It just illustrates how the Lord can deal with every detail and that God doesn't miss anything. The Italians, of course, lost the war, but some Italians survived and were allowed to prosper. I think what discernment the Lord shows in all his dealings. And again, brethren, I want to encourage you to look at your past, to try to see the Lord's hand in your family history and realize what a burden of responsibility that puts on each of us. We can only repay the blessings that past generations have given us by the way we live our lives today. It's an intriguing exercise to try to understand how the Lord has been intervening in man's affairs. Of course, the outcome of World War II is a very clear providence. God's plan would not be advanced by a German victory. Providence even used the evil intent of the Nazis to prepare the way for the rebirth of Israel. And as the psalmist says, surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain. And so as I look back on the war experiences of my father, I can see that God was simply preserving his life at that point, that's all. The best was yet to come, really. And I'll share with just a few more experiences of how the Lord drew him closer. There were a couple of experiences that were significant for him. And to show you how he was interested in knowing more about God, he says that one day, while living in Sicily, he had some questions about God, and he went to the local Catholic priest. And I asked him, well, what question did you have? And he says, I don't remember. But all I remember is he didn't have any answers. And as they were talking, the priest excused himself and left the room for a while. And as my dad looked around, he noticed a small magazine sitting on the table. And he picked it up and he thumbed through it and he saw, well, there's some interesting information in this. And it actually turned out to be an Italian Dawn magazine. He decided he needed it more than the priest did. And so he put it in his pocket. And when he got home, he ordered something. He wasn't sure what it was. He thought it was an Italian first volume, but he wasn't sure. And so that was the first official contact with the truth. But nothing really came of it while they were in Italy, except they started looking into things more carefully. And eventually my parents came to America and began meeting with a small group of Italian friends that they had met through my mother's brother. Now this group didn't know any truth. They were very nice people. I remember them. But they didn't have really anything to offer on a spiritual level, but they spoke Italian, and that was very important. So we met with them on Sunday afternoons. It was actually I believe it was a Methodist church. I remember sitting in pews. In fact, I remember lying on the pews while they were doing their thing. And the reason we could do that is because the minister was very kind, and this one of these Italian knew him. And so since they use it only in the morning, the place was available in the afternoon. Here's a picture of my dad at the podium of the church. Not that he was leading anything, but he was standing there with the leader of the little Italian group. And there on the left is a little band of Italians. My mother is the young one there with the dark hair because they don't smile. Smiling is not something Europeans did at the time. And that's me and my brother goofing around in the front. And now the providence that happened came through a little Italian brother named Brother Morello. I don't know what his first name was. He's not in either of these pictures because he wasn't a regular attender at these groups. But he would come once in a while because he spoke Italian. But the key was he also met with the Chicago Bible students. And I think the reason he would come to this group is because of his Italian background. He wanted to witness to them. And the other group really didn't pay much attention to what he was saying, but my parents did. They listened to him. And he invited them to come to the Chicago class, and they said, well, you know, we don't speak English, so there's no way we're going to get anything out of coming to an English meeting. But this is the interesting point. The Brother Morello didn't give up. Rather than saying, well, okay, if you don't want to go, that's okay, he went to some of the brethren in the Chicago class, and he says, you really should meet these people. They don't speak English, but you should meet these people. And he eventually arranged to have brethren come to visit us and have studies at our home. And I remember Brother Carl Higginsett coming, Brother George Tabak, Brother Ron Proskin coming, having regular meetings with my parents. And this Brother Morello would come and translate. And sometimes they tell me, I don't remember this, but they said when he couldn't make it, they tried to get me to be the translator. I was pretty young, and it didn't work out real well. In fact, I remember Sister Marilee Wessel used to come and have Bible classes with me and my brother. Well, eventually, because of the contact with these dear brethren, my parents felt comfortable enough, at least for the kids' sake, that they should start attending the Chicago class. And, of course, that's where I grew up because of that influence. Now, in hindsight, I can see that every step of the way was a providential overruling. And I think of how blessed I am because the Lord saw something in my parents and wanted to draw them closer. I want to show you one more picture. This is a picture of my dad on the left and Brother Walter Jurek on the right. I'm sure some of you remember him. Brother Walter on the right was the son-in-law of Dan and Nodi Morehouse. And I only appreciated this picture years later because now you know my dad's story on the German side. But Brother Walter Jurek landed on the beaches of Normandy on the American side. And I remember one of the international conventions after the convention, I think it was in France, he actually went to Normandy because he had to revisit where he saw the worst carnage of the war that he would ever see. What are the odds of an American landing on Normandy and an Italian being in the Russian front at the other end of the war, coming together at the Chicago Bible Student Ecclesia? It is absolutely got to be the hand of God. And I'll close with the words that I read earlier from Brother Russell. A glimpse of God's providence gives us a thrilling sense of mingled reverence, love, and adoration of the intellectual and moral glory of God. So, brethren, make the effort, take the time to look for the Lord's providence in your lives. Be honest when you look for providence. Be open to the fact that His providence may be different than what you want, but understand that His providence will always be better than what you want and always best for you. And then you can feel that sense of reverence, love, and adoration for our God who is so willing to bless us and keep us close to Him. May the Lord bless you all.